who is still waiting for, who's the, what's the chap out there called?
Michael.
Michael.
It's on the phone.
Yeah.
Start. Yeah.
Got it on. Thanks, Rosanna. So, the first thing I want you to look at is this extra sheet that was put on the table, Characters in As You Like It. And my plan this afternoon is we've got 45 minutes. I want to spend 20 minutes on this, and I want to spend 20 minutes on another poem. So, As You Like It is one of Shakespeare's most well-known plays, and we are seeing it next week mainly because it is a time when my on-campus students are going as well, so you'll be part of a larger ACU group of students. There's about 60 of us all together. Yep, Michael.
Are we referring to William Shakespeare?
William Shakespeare. You can refer to William Shakespeare.
No, is it? Did he
write it? He wrote it. Some people prefer to call him Bill Shakespeare. Some people just refer him as either Will or Bill. So this play has in it one of the most famous speeches that Shakespeare wrote, and that speech begins, "All the worlds are stage, all the world is a stage, and we are merely players." You might have heard of that. All the world's a stage and we are merely players. And yeah,
I heard of it, but I didn't know Shakespeare wrote it.
Yeah, he wrote it. And in London, he had the Globe Theatre, where he put on his plays. The Globe Theatre is a big circular theatre which has been recreated nowadays. And it's called the Globe because it is a metaphor for the world. And he really believed that the whole world was like on a stage. And we were all, like, at the moment, I'm standing here performing as a lecturer, a wise lecturer who knows lots of stuff, and you are sitting there performing the role of diligent students, soaking it all in, learning hard. But when we get out onto the streets, we go and have a beer, we do all sorts of other things, we play other roles. We're constantly playing roles. This is what Shakespeare meant: all the world's a stage and we are merely players. And last week and the week before, this is for the benefit of the newcomers, this course is dealing with the three different genres of literature: poetry, prose, and drama. It's an introduction to literature. We're looking at poetry at the moment. When we finish with this poetry, we're going to look at prose, the difference between prose and poetry. If you listen to the lecture from week one, it outlines that very clearly. And then drama. Drama is literature that walks and talks on stage. The interesting thing about Shakespeare is that Shakespeare's drama is often poetry on stage, poetry spoken, and it's got prose as well. Now, we do not have time to read As You Like It before the performance next Tuesday. That's one thing. We do not have the time to do it. You've got assignment to work on, you've got poetry to read, but it doesn't matter if you haven't read the play beforehand. I want you to experience the event on stage, but I do want you to know the story, and I'm going to go through that with you now. Later in the semester, you will have the text. I'm getting the text for you, and we're going to study parts of the play, and you're going to be putting parts of the play on in that auditorium out there. And all I'm saying is thank God for Jean, because she is the only woman in the cast, and she's going to have to play all the roles of all the women. No, not quite true. I've already got a woman's role lined up for Joey, and one for Michael, and one for Thomas.
It's okay. I'm comfortable.
tell you that in Shakespeare's time, women were not allowed on stage. So women were always men. And Shakespeare loved this concept. And all his plays often have women playing men, men playing women. He has that sort of idea running through his plays.
In some countries, that's still the case.
Still the case.
Was that in Shakespeare, Elizabethan or Victorian?
Elizabethan. Okay. Elizabeth I, who reigned from around about 1550 through to about 1603. And Queen Victoria was around about 1837 to 1903. Okay? So, first thing I've got here is the characters in As You Like It. So you've got the court of Duke Frederick, and then you've got the exiled court of Duke Senior. Now they're brothers. Duke Frederick and Duke Senior are brothers. Duke Frederick is the young Duke, and he has taken over all the territory from Duke Senior, and he's pushed him out. Been an argument between him, and Duke Senior has had to disappear into the forest. There's been a fight between two brothers. Then there's the household of the deceased Sir Roland de Boys. We don't see Sir Roland de Boys, but there are his sons Oliver and his son Orlando. And those two sons are also having a fight. Oliver, the oldest, has pushed Orlando, the youngest, out into the forest. So Shakespeare loves clashes in families. Then you've got, in the court of Duke Frederick, going back up to the top again, you've got two women. You've got Rosalind and Cecilia. Rosalind is the daughter of Duke Senior, and Celia is the daughter of Duke Frederick. But these two women are close friends, and they don't separate. They love each other more than sisters. Rosalind is perhaps one of the biggest female characters in any Shakespeare play, and she's strong and she's feisty. Remember, my mistress eyes are nothing like the sun? Shakespeare loved his feisty women. And they're down to earth, and we see his women in this play. The last group of characters are country folk in the Forest of Arden. Now, Shakespeare was writing at a time when there was a lot of tension between city life and country life, just as there is nowadays. And city life was seen to be evil, and country life was seen to be good. And he was writing at a time when, if you read something about Shakespeare, then you would read about this idea, the pastoral tradition. Pastoral tradition. And what that means, pastoral tradition, pastoral means of the country, the countryside. And it actually, this idea of pastoral tradition goes back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome. Because in ancient Greece and Rome, often poets like Virgil and Homer, they wrote about the way that country life gave you a soul and city life created tension and confusion. I was just got a taxi up from Central this afternoon because I was so hot and sweaty, and actually I had some blood taken out of me today at the doctor's and I was feeling a bit giddy, so I've got a taxi up here, but maybe I should have walked, because the taxi driver, he was so stressed out, he was going, oh God, these bloody buses, and there was hooting, etc, etc, and I paid about $15 to come from all the way from Central up to here. He went all around these back roads, he couldn't make it, he was tearing his hair out. I thought, city life, tension, stress. And that's exactly what Shakespeare is talking about, the stress of the city.
It's frantic.
Frantic. That's it. It's frantic. And the country life is something different. Now, this play is about brothers and dukes who want to hold on to power in the city, and people who escape into the country. And in the country, they find shepherds and shepherdesses. And the shepherds, of course, well, what are the shepherds doing? All day long they're thinking about love. And what are the shepherdesses doing all the time? They're thinking about love. And the play's got these two worlds. And the world of the shepherdesses, the pastoral world, Shakespeare is saying that's where we need to find our heart, our soul. And that's, in fact, where this play finds its heart and its soul.
That's where you get grounded.
That's beautiful, perfect. That's where you get grounded.
The country is the heart and soul of the city, because if it wasn't for the country,
yep.
you wouldn't have the fresh milk.
Exactly. Exactly. If you wouldn't have, if there was no country, there'd be no possibility of a city. Fresh milk and all the fruit and all that sort of stuff which comes from the country. Now, what I've got here is a nice little summary of the whole story. And because I think this might end up in the bottom of a pile of books, and you might not read it before the theatre, I'm going to read it to you now. And then I'd like you to read it again for yourselves before the theatre. There was once a wicked duke named Frederick, who took the dukedom that should have belonged to his brother Duke Senior, sending him into exile. That means pushing him out away from the city. His brother Duke Senior went into the forest of Arden. Now, for us French speakers in the room, Tibby and Jean, it's actually the forest of Ardennes. I don't know if you've been to the forest of Ardennes. You know where it is. But interestingly enough, there was a forest near where Shakespeare lived, and it was called Arden. So there's an interesting connection. So he went into the forest of Arden, where he lived the life of a bold forester, as Robin Hood did in Sherwood Forest in Merry England. You might not know who Robin Hood is, but Robin Hood is a bit like an English version of Ned Kelly, who lived in the forest, and he was a bad man as far as the city was concerned, but he robbed wealthy people and gave what he robbed to the poor. The banished Duke Senior's daughter, Rosalind, remained with Celia, Frederick's daughter, and the two loved each other more than most sisters. One day, there was a wrestling match at court, and Rosalind and Celia went to see it. Charles, a celebrated wrestler, was there, who had killed many men in contests of this kind. Orlando, the young man he was to wrestle with, was so slender and youthful that Rosalind and Celia thought he would surely be killed as others had been. So they spoke to him and asked him not to attempt so dangerous an adventure. But the only effect of their words was to make him wish more to come off well in the encounter so as to win praise from such sweet ladies. Orlando, like Rosalind's father, Duke Senior, was being kept out of his inheritance by his brother, Oliver. And he was so sad at his brother's unkindness that until he saw Rosalind, he did not care much whether he lived or died. But now the sight of the fair Rosalind gave him strength and courage, so that he did marvellously in the fight, and at last threw Charles the wrestler to such a tune that the wrestler had to be carried off the ground. Duke Frederick was pleased with his courage and asked his name. "My name is Orlando, and I'm the youngest son of Sir Roland de Boys," said the young man. Now, Sir Roland de Boys, when he was alive, had been a good friend to the banished Duke Senior, so that Duke Frederick heard with regret whose son Orlando was and would not befriend him. But Rosalind was delighted to hear that this handsome young stranger was the son of her father's old friend. And as they were going away, she turned back more than once to say another kind word to the brave young man. "Gentlemen," she said, giving him a chain from her neck, "wear this for me. I could give more, but that my hand lacks means." So Rosalind, has already become in love with Orlando. Rosalind and Celia, when they were alone, began to talk about the handsome wrestler, and Rosalind confessed that she loved him at first sight. "Come, come," said Celia, "wrestle with thy affections." So Celia is suggesting that, you know, Rosalind shouldn't allow her affections and her attraction to get the better of her. "Oh," answered Rosalind, "they take the part of a better wrestler than myself." So Rosalind is saying that the affections that she has for Orlando are very hard to stop. "Look, here comes Duke Frederick." "With his eyes full of anger," said Celia. "You must leave the court at once," said Duke Frederick to Rosalind. "Why?" she asked. "Never mind why," answered the Duke. "You're banished. If within 10 days you're found within 20 miles of my court, you die." And the reason that Duke Frederick has said this is because Rosalind's father was friends with the Duke de Boys, who Frederick hated. So Rosalind set out to seek her father, the banished Duke Senior, in the Forest of Arden. Celia loved her too much to let her go alone. Celia, of course, is the daughter of the Duke Frederick. And as it was rather a dangerous journey, Rosalind, being the taller, dressed up as a young countryman and her cousin as a country girl. And Rosalind said that she would be called Ganymede and Celia Aliena. So these two girls have been banished, or at least Rosalind has been banished, and they decide to dress up. Rosalind, who's a tall girl, she decides to dress up as a man. And she goes to the forest dressed like a man, and her friend Celia is her girlfriend, Aliena. They were very tired when at last they came to the Forest of Arden, and as they were sitting on the grass, a countryman passed that way. And Ganymede, Rosalind dressed up as a man, asked him if he could get them food. He did so and told them that a shepherd's flock and house were to be sold. They bought these and settled down as shepherd and shepherdess in the forest. So this is, oh, it's all a fairy tale, really. It's an elaborate fairy tale, and it's actually, this story was based on a novel that was written in Shakespeare's times. Okay, next paragraph. In the meantime, Oliver, having sought to take his brother Orlando's life, Orlando also wandered into the forest and there met with the rightful Duke Senior, and being kindly received, stayed with him. Now Orlando could think of nothing but Rosalind, and he went about the forest carving her name on trees and writing love sonnets and hanging them on bushes. Remember Shakespeare's sonnet we looked at last week, "My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun." So Orlando was going around carving sonnets and poems on all the trees in the forest because he was so obsessed with Rosalind. And there, Rosalind and Celia found them. They found these poems. One day, Orlando met them, but he did not know Rosalind in her boy's clothes, though he liked the pretty shepherd youth because he fancied a likeness in him to her he loved. So when Orlando looks at this young boy, Orlando thinks, it's not my girlfriend, Rosalind, but this boy looks a little bit like Rosalind. Remember that Shakespeare himself was bisexual. I think I mentioned that last week. So there's always a little element of this in his plays. "There is a foolish lover," said Rosalind, "who haunts these woods and hangs sonnets on the trees. If I could find him, I would soon cure him of his folly." Orlando confessed that he was the foolish lover. And Rosalind said, "If you will come and see me every day, I will pretend to be Rosalind, and I will take her part and be wayward and contrary, as is the way of women, till I make you ashamed of your folly in loving her." So there's this curious game that goes on. Rosalind dresses a man, says, "You come and pretend that I'm your girlfriend, even though I'm a boy, and I'll act as if you were Rosalind." And so every day he went to her house and took pleasure in saying to her all the pretty things that he would have said to Rosalind. And she had the fine and secret joy of knowing that all his love words came to the right ears. Thus many days passed pleasantly away. One morning, as Orlando was going to visit Ganymede, that's Rosalind dressed up as a man, Orlando saw a man asleep on the ground and saw also that there was a lioness crouching near, waiting for the man who was asleep to wake up. Because they say that lions will not prey on anything that is dead or sleeping, but the lion will stay there and pounce once the person wakes up. Orlando looked at the man and saw that it was his wicked brother, Oliver, who tried to take his life. And what did Orlando do? Out of the goodness of his heart, he fought with the lioness and killed her and saved his brother's life. While Orlando was fighting the lioness, Oliver woke to see his brother, whom he had treated so badly, saving him from a wild beast at the risk of his own life. This made him repent of his wickedness, and he begged Orlando's pardon, and from thenceforward they were dear brothers. The lioness had wounded Orlando's arm so much that he could not go on to see the shepherd, so he sent his brother to ask Ganymede to come to him. Ganymede, of course, being Rosalind dressed up as a man. Oliver went and told the whole story to Ganymede and Aliena, and Aliena was so charmed with his manly way of confessing his faults that she fell in love with him, Oliver, at once. But when Ganymede heard of the danger Orlando had been in, she fainted. And when she came to herself, she said, "Truly enough, I should have been a woman by right." Oliver went back to his brother and told him all this, saying, "I love Aliena so well that I will give up my estates to you and marry her and live here as a shepherd." "Let your wedding be tomorrow," said Orlando, "and I will ask Duke Senior and his friends." When Orlando told Ganymede how his brother was to be married on the morrow, he added, "Oh, how bitter a thing it is to look into happiness through another man's eyes." Then answered Rosalind, still in Ganymede's dress and speaking with his voice, to Orlando, "If you do love Rosalind so near the heart, then when your brother marries Aliena, shall you marry her? You will marry Rosalind." Now the next day, Duke Senior and his followers, and Orlando, and Oliver, and the Aliena were all gathered together for the wedding. Then Ganymede came in and said to the Duke, "If I bring in your daughter Rosalind, will you give her to Orlando here?" "That I would," said the Duke, "if I had all the kingdoms to give with her." "And you say you will have her when I bring her?" she said to Orlando. "That would I," he answered, "were I king of all kingdoms." Then Rosalind and Celia went out, and Rosalind put on her pretty woman's clothes again, and after a while came back. She turned to her father. "I give myself to you, for I am yours. If there be truth in sight," he said, "you are my daughter." Then she said to Orlando, "I give myself to you, for I am yours." "If there be truth in sight," he said, "you are my Rosalind." "I will have no father if you be not he," she said to the Duke. And to Orlando, "I will have no husband if you be not he." So Orlando and Rosalind were married, and Oliver and Celia, and they lived happy ever after, returning with Duke Senior to the kingdom. For Duke Frederick had been shown by a holy hermit the wickedness of his ways, and so gave back the dukedom of his brother, and himself went into a monastery to pray for forgiveness. The wedding was a merry one in the mossy glades of the forest. A shepherd and shepherdess who had been friends with Rosalind when she was herself, disguised as a shepherd, were married on the same day, and all with such pretty feastings and merrymakings as could be nowhere within four walls, but only in the beautiful green wood. Now, as you can see, this is quite a complex story, and it'll take a few rereadings of this to get clear in your own head who is what and what is who. I've added at the end a very short paragraph from the Royal Shakespeare Company's plot summary, which summarizes even more concisely what I've just read and adds a few things that are not included in this prose translation of the story of As You Like It. But I can guarantee that if you study these few pages, it'll make a big difference when you go to the theatre next week. You will understand why the Dukes are fighting, why Rosalind is dressed up in men's clothes, why all these poems are appearing on the trees, and the play will mean a lot more to you. And when you come to look at the text in about 5 weeks' time, 4 weeks' time, it'll begin to make much more sense for you. So, let's move on now. We've got 20 minutes left to this next poem that we're going to look at. And this is a poem that you might decide you want to look at for your assignment. This poem is on page 9. I'm going to clean these boards off in case I need some more blackboard space. Correct. Now, that's it. We don't want any Chinese berries this week. Now, I want to say something about this poem to begin with. Last week, we looked at a poem by the Australian author Judith Wright, about a wattle tree, and we discovered as we plunged into that poem that the poem, while it was about a wattle tree, became increasingly about the poet's own search for a way of speaking that was in harmony with the wattle tree, and the wattle tree almost became a symbol for what she wanted to speak about, which was an experience of wholeness that was expressed in the symbolism of this yellow ball of gold that reflected the gold of the sun, which is the creator of all life. So in a way, that poem is a deeply religious poem, transcending all specific religions, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, something that connected with Judith Wright's own search for her own inner creativity, her voice. And this poem is by an American, and that's the American there. His name is Galway Kinnell. Interesting kind of Irish name, Galway. He came out to Australia a few years ago. I remember going to a poetry reading with him, and he actually read this amazing poem about an event that he'd experienced. He'd been in the coldest part of Canada near Alaska, and he'd nearly died of exposure because he got lost on a walk, and there was a dead bear, and he saved his own life by cutting the bear open and getting inside the bear. And when he was inside the bear, he wrote this poem about the dream of the bear. And he fell asleep inside the bear and had a dream of what it was like to be in a bear. I remember this poem. It was a long poem. It was just incredible. It was just amazing. It was sort of, how could you do that? How could that, you know, there it was.
Only a poet.
Only a poet.
Well, they did in Star Wars, they cut out the cannon.
That's it.
The dream with counteraction.
That's it. Now, this poem has got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 lines. Can anybody remember what I said about a 14-line poem last week?
Sonnet.
It's a sonnet, Joey. Well done. And Shakespeare wrote the sonnet, "My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun." And Galway Kinnell has written a sonnet here. And often, sonnets have a certain structure. Often they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines, and then they have 6 lines. And why do I say 8 and 6? 8 and 6 do make 14, of course they do. Of course they've got 8 lines and they've got 6 lines. What am I talking about? But what often happens is that after the 8th line, there's something else happens. And this is sometimes called the volta. Those of you who know Italian will know what that means. There's a turn. It turns.
Oh, wow.
Turns. So something turns after 8 lines. I'm not sure whether it happens in this poem. Let's see. Let's try and discover it. I put these definitions at the bottom because, as you'll see, they're quite important. Let me read the poem. I love to go out in late September. Now let's think of this for a minute. Late September in the Northern Hemisphere is autumn. So actually late September is sort of like now in a way. Autumn, when in Australia blackberries are starting to come out now in March, April. In Northern Hemisphere, September, October. I love to go out in late September among the fat, overripe, icy, black blackberries. To eat blackberries for breakfast, the stalks very prickly, a penalty they earn for knowing the black art of blackberry making. And as I stand among them lifting the stalks to my mouth, the ripest berries fall almost unbidden to my tongue, as words sometimes do. Certain peculiar words like strength or squinched, many lettered, one-syllabled lumps, which I squeeze, squinch open, and splurge well in the silent, startled, icy, black language of blackberry eating in late September. Now, I know you think I'm a nutcase. Anybody who reads a poem like that must be crazy. Well, I'm not, I am passionate, but what I'm what I was trying to get across was the way that poetry gives so much attention to the sounds of words. And this poem turns the sounds of the words into blackberries. The sound, squinched, squelched, splurged. You know, words are, they're physical objects. Words, you know, words are not just meanings through which we look to find a meaning, but in poetry, words draw attention to themselves by becoming the thing they're talking about. That's what poetry is all about. Poetry is like a dance. It's not just an idea, it brings something physically onto the page. So every word here is its sound, and you know, we're talking about, if we go back to the question you've got for your essay, poetic devices. Poetic devices in this instance here is a lot of intentional use of sound. Now, there are many different kinds of sounds that are used in poetry. Let me just write down some of them. There's alliteration. There's assonance. There's consonants. There's onomatopoeia. My mother, who was German, who taught me German, who taught me English and German, she said, English is a stupid language. English, always the spelling is stupid. If you want to learn how to spell in English, you have to spell it phonetically. So my mother, I remember her telling me when I was about 4 years old, because, bekause, bekause. And it stuck in my head, bekause. And onomatopoeia, onomatopoeia. Altogether, try it. Onomatopoeia. You'll never forget it now. Onomatopoeia. And onomatopoeia is, it's a poetic device when the sound of the word equals the word, equals the thing itself. Onomatopoeia. So, quack, quack is onomatopoeia. You write Q-U-A-K-C-K. Quack, quack is onomatopoeia for the sound that a duck makes. Or meow is the sound that a cat makes. Or woof, woof is the sound that a dog makes. That's onomatopoeia. But onomatopoeia can also be things like overripe, icy, black blackberries. Oh, I can feel them going down my throat. The sounds of the words, they've got a juice in them. You know, you can almost feel the juice running out of those words. Yes, Michael?
Something I use all the time when there's ooh, A-W-E, it's like ooh.
Yep.
Is that an, whatever, what is?
I'm not quite understanding, Michael. When you use what?
Oh, I'll just say you're being romantic and a girl likes A-W-E-O.
Yeah.
The word's a sound. It's
an emotional expression, which,
yeah,
which if you put it down as a word,
A-W-E-O.
And it is onomatopoeia.
Yeah, so
exactly. Yeah. I hope you have to write that often, do you?
Guys, that the word is just not masculine. But
that's it. So, just here, alliteration is first letters, first letter consonant. Now, you know that English language is made up of vowels and consonants. The vowels are a, e, I, o, u, and there's also diphthongs, a, and e, o. Vowels a sound coming up through the voice box, and it's sound that's not interrupted. Look. It's not interrupted, it flows through. But the moment I put consonants there, look what happens. Consonants is immediately either tongue or lip or mouth constricting it. Consonants. And words are made up of consonants and vowels, a mixture. But a poet can use these combinations to create a music. I love to go out in late September among the fat, overripe, icy, black blackberries to eat blackberries for breakfast. Buh, 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 and black. And the other, I haven't put up here, another one is repetition. Repetition. So alliteration is when the first letter is a consonant, like buh, black, breakfast. Assonance is the repetition of consonants at the beginning. Repetition of vowels at beginning of words. So, for instance, have we got any examples of assonance here? Anybody found one? What line is that? They earn for knowing the black art. They earn the black art of Well, that's not a repetition. So there's not any clear examples of assonance. Assonance is the repetition of vowels at the beginning. Alliteration is the repetition of consonants at the beginning. Consonants is the chiming of consonants inside words. So that, for example, you've got prickly, penalty. You've got L's there chiming with each other. Onomatopoeia we've covered. And repetition is when we've got repetition of words like blackberries, and so on. So there's lots of sound effects in this poem. Now, I spoke here about the turn between 8 and 6. Now what happens? Look, it begins here, it begins at this point as. Now let's have a look at this more closely. I love to go out in late September among the fat, overripe, icy black blackberries to eat blackberries for breakfast. That's all pretty straightforward and pretty clear, although he's making a strong point that he really loves this, and the love he has is expressed in the way that he describes the fat, overripe, icy black. You know, there's a lot of adjectives here. Adjectives, fat, overripe, icy, black. Adjectives put in front of the noun. So many adjectives in front of noun. Now, blackberry is a noun. Blackberry is a noun, okay? Now, what is a noun? I tell you what a noun is. A noun is a thing or an object. But the best way of working out what a noun is if you can put the in front of it. The. If I can put the in front of a word, that is actually, grammatically, it's called an article. It's an article. And that's a definite article. And there's another kind of an article called a, which is indefinite. I can say a blackberry or a or the blackberry. I can say a table or that table. I can say a clock or the clock. But I can't say a beautiful or that beautiful. I've got to add something else to it. I've got to say the beautiful man or a beautiful blackberry. Beautiful is not a noun, it is an adjective. It's telling us something about the noun. So when I say there are many adjectives in front of the noun is blackberry, and he's got fat, overripe, icy black blackberries. How many things can you put into the bowl? In normal English, we don't put usually so many adjectives in front of the noun. But when you're a poet, you can make the meaning expand by stuffing all these adjectives in front of the noun. Fat, overripe, icy, black, blackberries, yum! To eat blackberries for breakfast. He likes doing that, but there's something a bit funny in this line. The stalks, very prickly. Who's picked blackberries, by the way? Yeah, you all know what it's like when you see that beautiful, big, beautiful black blackberry. You're going, ah, the blood is pouring out of the end of my finger. I didn't get the bastard. The stalks, very prickly, a penalty they know, they earn for knowing the black art of blackberry making. So there's something sort of rather secret being said about these blackberries. Their stalks are prickly, and that's a penalty. Penalty. They know the black art of blackberry making. It's as if blackberries are being given some kind of unearthly quality. It's a bit like the wattle tree in Judith Wright. The wattle tree creates this word of gold. Here, blackberries have got this black art of blackberry making. And as I stand among them, lifting the stalks to my mouth, the ripest berries fall almost unbidden to my tongue as words sometimes do. And immediately that comes in there. Hang on a second. What's this poem talking about? What's the black art of blackberry making? What are these marks on the page if they are not black marks? What connection is there between blackberries and blackberries? Is there any kind of connection between this object here made up of black marks and this object here made up of black marks? Let's read on. As words sometimes do. Well, blackberries fall almost unbidden to my tongue, but words, certain peculiar words like strength or squinched, having eyes half closed in order to see better, squinched eyes. Squinched. Splurge. A blustering demonstration or great effort. A great display. To make a great display in any way, especially in oratory. Splurge. As words like strength or squinched. Many lettered. One-syllabled lumps. One-syllabled lumps. Many lettered. Which I squeeze. Squinch open. And splurge well in the silent, startled, icy, black language of blackberry eating in late September.
It looks like a kind of alliteration or something.
It's alliteration. But is this poem about blackberry eating? Or is it about poetry making? That black art. The black art, the icy black language.
Well, it's what? I mean, at the Malta, he switches from, you know, blackberry eating into figurative, and he starts talking about...
Beautiful, well put. At the Volta, he talks about words, and it becomes figurative. So the poem begins to turn from something that is beautifully about the physical act of eating blackberries into a poem about the way that blackberries have stimulated these words that have created this poem.
Talking about the tree and the blackberries in the same context.
In the same context.
Because he's passionate about that, he's passionate about the tree.
That's right, that's right. So good on you, Galway. You've foxed us again. We're all totally confused now. Are we, Joey?
There's no confusion.
That's fantastic.
That'd be no line.
I'm speaking for myself. I'm not speaking for the whole guy.
Yeah. So there's another poem. If you want to give it a go, give it a best shot. See, one thing that's really interesting about the act of writing, this task that you've got, this 300-word task, whichever poem you choose, and I would encourage you to, I don't mind if you use any of the poems we've done, but I would encourage you to go where you would like your imagination to go. What do I mean by that? I mean, challenge yourself a little. If you do this essay, I can tell you you're all going to pass. If you work with your learning partner and write this essay, none of you are going to fail, because your learning partner is going to ensure that what you produce is well written. And you're going to have a ball working with your learning partner, trying to work out what these poems are trying to say and how they, what they're trying to do. And for myself, if I give myself the task of writing about a poem, it's amazing what you discover yourself. There's more there than meets the eye.
Yes.
That's it. You, writing is a way of kind of digging into your own feelings and thoughts and mind. It really is. It's a way of discovering things about yourself you never knew. So, go for it! And I will see you. I'm going to be around here now for a little while you, those of you who want to work on the computer. But after that, I will see you all at 6 o'clock at the Opera House next Tuesday. Okay? Yep.
Earlier on, you mentioned that there's a block required every week.
Yep, it's in the unit outline.
And here, the unit outline shows almost every 2 weeks.
Does it show it almost every 2 weeks, does it? Okay, that's interesting.
It doesn't matter. Why can't you do one book?
You can do as many as you like. But at the end of the day...
What's required?
Yeah, what's required? You're going to be judged on 4 or 5 of your best blogs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it's got every 2 weeks.
Right. So you've got 4. Yeah, exactly.
That's it. That's right. That's right. Was there anything else I had to say?
And there's one short essay at the end.
Yeah.
4 blogs, but one short essay.
That's it. That's it. So you can choose your best of the blogs that you do. Yep. Yep. Okay. All finished? 6 o'clock on Tuesday night, Opera House.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Great. Yeah, the drama theatre, which is on the outside. Outside on the left-hand side when you walk in. You don't go up the stairs to the opera theatre, but you stay down on the ground level.
Yeah.
The drama theatre's on the left-hand side, looking towards the harbour bridge.
It's not
at the front, it's down the side, the left-hand side. As you walk towards the opera house, it's on the left-hand side of the building. Okay? Ground level.
And that's where they